You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it. People who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God is doing there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and this week we get to dive into another rural resource. From time to time, we love to highlight books, podcasts, and other avenues to learn about what it means to pastor or lead in a small town setting, even just beyond our own podcast. And so I have been reading a set of books that just have been so awesome, like from the practical to the philosophical, from the spiritual tone, but also the leadership acumen. I've just been really enjoying this set of books this spring. The author's name is Carl Vaders, and I'm excited because in a couple weeks, sometime in April, at the time of this recording, it's nearing the end of March, we are going to have Pastor Carl Vaders on our podcast to discuss a couple of his books, one of which is called The Grasshopper Myth, talking about small churches and how we don't necessarily have to have small thinking, even if we're in a small place. And then another one called Desizing the Church, which is just one of my favorite books right now. It talks a lot about how to measure ministry success beyond just the numbers, right? Which is music to a lot of our small town ears. A third book of his that I've been just reading personally is called Small Church Essentials and Field-Tested Principles for Leading a Healthy Congregation of Under 250. Now, some of us might say, is that small church? You know, I know for me, sometimes it's as small as 20 or 40 or 100. But really, I've started reading this book. I'm personally about halfway through at the time of this recording. But it was so chock full of good stuff that I just could not help but talk about it today. And so I'm going to do what I always do. You're going to get to go on a journey with me as I just kind of thumb through the pages of this book and look at the spots that I've marked and the principles that have stood out to me. And as we discuss it, I just want to encourage you to give this kind of resource a shot. Again, I am always looking to learn and do better in my context, and the wisdom found in these pages has just been so enlightening to me. And so as I walk through this, number one, I just want to kind of embrace and really highlight the credibility of Carl Vaders as an author and as a pastor. He's definitely, he kind of has spent a chunk of his ministry in the shadow of Saddleback Church with Rick Warren, which of course was this kind of bastion of church growth. It really was the we can make church numerically succeed if we try hard enough and institute the right programs, et cetera, et cetera. And what I've appreciated about the author is that I feel like Pastor Carl has done a good job of saying, hey, I am rooting for the success of this church. You know, I'm not just standing idly by and saying, ho-hum, and I wish that, you know, we did that or had that. And in reality, he said it's just not even the call or the destiny or the preference that all these churches turn into these mega churches. He says to be small is not a problem. And so he starts this book out by just highlighting that, saying, hey, it is not an issue to be small. It is not an issue to stay small. What is a bigger issue is, are we healthy or unhealthy? And so he starts walking us through kind of the principles that it's going to take for us to have that conversation. Again, even in kind of his intro, he really stopped and he talked about some excuses, right? That as small churches, we talk about limited resources, you know, lack of extra people, lack of those serving, et cetera, et cetera. And I just really loved, he sets the tone by having these declarations of faith, right? He says, just because we don't have a kickin' worship band does not mean we will settle for passionless worship. Lack of sermon prep time because of a bivocational schedule does not have to mean bad theology or passionless preaching. Minimal finances does not have to stop us from being generous, and not having professional graphics, flyers, website, that kind of thing will not stop us from inviting our friends to church. I really love how he just starts the book by shifting the focus away from what you don't have and really saying, what do you have and how can we operate on these principles we all believe in, regardless of size? As he kicks off kind of the practical points of the chapter, I really love this quote, and it's a quote from Tim Keller, but it talks about how sometimes we draw the wrong comparisons from size, right? And he says, honestly, the difference between how churches of 100 operate and churches of 1,000 operate may be much greater than the difference between a Presbyterian and a Baptist church of the same size. I think it's important to note that sometimes when we are within our own tribe or our own kind of unique denomination of Christianity, sometimes we draw these comparisons and we say, well, that Baptist church or that Assemblies of God church or that Presbyterian church has 1,000, I have 100, but I need to be like my sister church in a sense, you know, when in reality, sometimes we just have to pause and go, hey, the numbers of our church dictate the systems by which our church operates much more than even our denominational differences. I thought that was a fascinating insight. It really helped ground me in saying, hey, I don't need to be worrying about how I compare to those within my tribe, but I should be concerned about, like, what does it take to run a successful church of 100? You know, because again, the way we interact with congregation members, the way we treat our programming, our board meetings, everything, our youth ministries, our kids ministries, it's all going to boil down a lot more to the size of our congregation and not necessarily to the denominational flavor it has. I also really love this insight. I think all of us have probably sat in meetings where we hear what we may call quote-unquote big church principles. There might be a new program or a way of interacting or a certain slogan or vision or tagline. And you kind of wonder and say, man, how much of this is useful? You know, how much can I actually take back? And I think as small church pastors, it's easy to wrestle with, well, I took the big idea, I tried to apply it, and it was met with this crazy resistance, and now I've kind of given up on it, or I did implement it, and it's kind of burned out my church instead of growing it, which is so unique, you know, and I've definitely been there. You know, For a season of ministry, when I was doing youth ministry, I noticed that some larger churches kind of had this momentum where they were able to split their middle and high school. And we were running probably the highest numbers we ever had. And I was so excited. I said, you know, let's try this. So we built it up. And it just tanked. Like, it just crushed the momentum of the youth ministry. And I spent a lot of kind of energy and capital on it. And I look back on that season and say, man, I kind of missed it. Like, I think I was pumped by this big idea and maybe just missed how it could actually apply in the context. But there's a quote in here that says this: on average, about 1/3 of the big church principles can be applied in a church of 200, and only about 1/4 of those principles can be applied in a church of 100 or fewer. To know which third or quarter to keep, I have to understand how big churches and small churches are different. And what follows is just a bunch of one-liners. I'm going to read them to you, reflect on them. But he starts talking about the differences in big churches and small church. And to be clear, I'm not a huge fan of overemphasizing these differences. Like, I don't think, you know, at the end of the day, we all love Jesus. And I do think sometimes there's too much leaning into our cultural context. Like, at the end of the day, reaching people for Jesus, connecting with other leaders who have the same heart and mind, that transcends the size of our church. However, the practical rules and ramifications about how churches function at different sizes matter a lot. The first thing he says, the bigger the group, the more predictably they behave. And the smaller the group, the less predictably they behave. The smaller the group, he goes on to say, the more the idiosyncrasies of individual people and the relationships between them come into play. And when I read this, it just clicked in my brain. Well, of course that's how we lead. Like, when you make a decision in a group of 1,000 people, the prevailing opinion is that we will kind of submit just by default to the needs of the group. And so there's this sense of, like, a uniform response. And even if there's a couple people in those ranks who dissent or really don't like the direction, they're much more likely to go with whatever the large group flow is. And in a small church, you might be beating your head against a wall because what you're not taking into account when you're making decisions is, wait, the personalities involved matter a lot. You've got people who their opinion just matters a ton, and it's going to emerge way more because your sample size is just inherently smaller. Instead of a board meeting where we're having 1,000 people there, it's saying, hey, there's 100 people in this church in a board of 5 or 4 or 3 even, and you're saying, here's how the decision-making process works, and it just leaves so much more room for expression. And I know for me, that just helps ground me. I'm not expecting quick decisions. I'm saying, oh, I know that when I bring this up, I'm going to get a lot of individual opinions, and I'm going to have to work through them slowly as a pastor. I also enjoyed how they talked about how attendance actually weirdly matters less in a small church than it does in a large church. Just in the way we lead and preach, right? Like in a large church, let's say there were 5,000 Sunday attenders. If they had a fluctuation on either side, maybe 2,500 one week, 75 another, 7,500 another, there would be massive shifts in that church's infrastructure. There would be alarm bells of what's going on and what's happening. Whereas in a small church, you just kind of have a built-in expectation, or rather you should have a built-in expectation, that these fluctuations are not a sign of an unfruitful ministry. They're just the natural flow of life. It's a lot easier to notice, you know, maybe on the first day of hunting season or a certain season of farming for the year, your attendance drops to 25 when it was 50. And maybe for a baptism or a child dedication or graduation, it jumps up to 75 or even 100. And the thing is, we just have to not be as rattled about shifts in attendance, because truthfully, they're just not the main barometric measure for how we're measuring success. And so again, a lot of these things brought me a lot of comfort when I read some of those kind of rules that govern small churches, right? There was another kind of insight, and again, I'm just thumbing page by page, but he talks about this. He says, when pastors of large churches get together, they can learn a lot from each other because they have so much in common, which I think is true. I mean, by the time you get to a certain size, you should hopefully be employing these kind of universally agreed upon best practices that fit a church of that size. Again, once a church reaches 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 and beyond, everyone's kind of agreed that there's a way of doing church. There's still unique expression. I am really not trying to paint a broad brush over large churches, but I think it's true that if there was a better way to do worship on a large scale or discipleship on a large scale, like, those churches would be highlighted, those lessons would be learned, and they would be adopted by a lot of people, you know? However, the smaller the church, the more unique the setting is. That's why I think even in this doing this podcast for the several years now that I've been hosting it, it's been so crazy to me how unique each church setting is. You might, as a small town church pastor, be facing a set of problems that is genuinely unique to your setting. And I'm talking like unique, unique. You might say, man, have you ever had this particular flavor of personalities mixing together? Have you ever had this ministry just completely fall out from underneath you? Have you ever had this unique kind of upset where somebody who's more controlling, somebody who's less controlling, the way conflict works out, the way certain families and influences work, the way that even small town dynamics affect your church? You know, well, these people both serve on city council and they can't stand each other, so they won't attend church together. I mean, it's so unique how these things play out. And again, that gives me a lot of grace for each of the individual churches that I get to interact with through a podcast like this, for the individual leaders. And I would hope that it would give you grace. When you're seeking out advice, don't be upset if it doesn't seem to all fit. Instead, try and find listening voices and try and give yourself some slack. The problems and challenges that you may be facing are unique to you because they are just unique. And so be at peace, right? Don't immediately chalk yourself up as a failure because you're kind of encountering this unique kind of personalities at play. Instead, lean into it and say, okay, how do I get creative? You know, yes, take wise counsel, but ultimately say, God, what is your creative decision for this context and this place? Because odds are the way you have to handle something is unique and different from how the agreed upon method might be. Going on, talking about priorities within the small church, he says this. He said, big churches need to prioritize vision, process, and programs, which, again, I would agree. When I hear a lot of, you know, just my own interactions with some of the larger churches in my sphere of influence, they talk a lot about, man, we had to revamp our vision statement, or here's the culture we're trying to set, here's our Big Ten Commandments of how we're leading, you know, things like that. They talk a lot about improving processes. You know, they'll say things like, well, the way we onboard leaders needs some work, or the way we've integrated students, or the way we've done small groups. And they'll talk about programs, say, yeah, we're really cutting this to make room for this and really trying to streamline this. And it's not a bad thing. It's just meeting a need of a large church. When you have a lot of people involved, you have to be concerned about these things so that the people you're dealing with, the large amount of people you're dealing with, can have an unhindered experience of the gospel. But in a small church, they talked about the need to prioritize relationships, culture, and history. It says that in small churches, the way that we establish vision, processes, and programs is just entirely different. To kind of lead with this charismatic vision statement can feel really empowering to a large church, but in a small church, it can feel manipulative or too forced or kind of bulldozing over the top of things. It means that the way we establish change and culture means that we have to do it one by one through a series of relationships. It has to be slow and deliberate. I really love the example they gave. They talk about culture, right, and how to set good culture. And there was a reference to the parable of the soil, right? Jesus describes the gospel seed getting scattered on these four soils in Matthew 13, talking about how there's, you know, the hard ground that doesn't receive the seed. There's rocky soil where it kind of grows up quickly. There's soil that's grown over by weeds where it kind of, again, chokes out the growth of the plant. And then there's good soil. And truthfully, each of our churches is probably at a different place in this soil, right? They have different levels of receptiveness. And as a small church pastor, you just might find yourself, instead of saying, oh, I'm navigating a change to improve a process, a program, or enact a vision, you might be saying, I'm busy creating the kind of place where these ideas can flourish, where I'm working through, I'm turning up stone by stone by stone. Again, to use a very rural agrarian example, you talk to a farmer about getting rocks out of a field or moving it. It is a painful one at a time, let's get it out of there kind of process. I mean, picking rocks is something people get paid pretty handsomely for at times because it's such a grueling job. But as a small church pastor, we just kind of need to be prepared that in setting the tone for our church, when we talk about history, relationships, culture, all those things take an incredibly long time. They are not just this easy fix, right? I really love, as we continue on, he does a whole chapter entitled, and I just got to get back to it here, Untold Secrets About Church Health and Growth, right? And again, I really admire this author's way just to break it down, make it really chewable, accessible, if you will, to kind of dive into these principles. But his first secret is bigger fixes nothing. And I love that because for a small church, again, that's music to my ears to say, hey, the problems I have and the problems I would have if we were bigger are not different problems. And it shifts my focus. Instead of saying, well, let's just focus on growth. It's like, no, let's focus on being healthy. Let's do something that's really within our grasp, because then if we do grow, we will be bigger and healthy instead of bigger and unhealthy. His exact phrasing is, being small does not mean that something is broken. If something is broken, you cannot fix it by making it bigger. This was reinforced for me in a surprising and likely place. And he goes on to talk about fixer-upper shows and restaurants and kind of all these things, you know. And he talked about how when these people would go into these businesses and the restaurants and the failing establishments, never ever would they say, oh, I think that you just need to buy a bigger restaurant. It's like, well, if you triple your seating capacity, you'll fix the restaurant. Instead, it mostly boiled down to, what are we doing well? How do we make it simple? How do we make it effective? How do we trim the fat, cut the corners? Sorry, cutting corners has a negative, but like cut out all the excess and just get back to being a healthy small business that then has a healthy place to launch from. And I think churches are the same. You know, I think we talk a lot about just, you know, trying to get bigger, trying to grow. Because again, we want to have gospel impact. But truth be told, health matters so much more. if we had more money, we'd probably have more problems on how to where to spend that money. If we built a bigger church, we'd have more opinions on how that church needs to be built. If we added all these things, it's not going to fix the mix of personalities, the culture we're setting, the relationships and history we're navigating. Instead, we need to tackle these things first so that as we eye growth, as we work on outreach, we're doing it from a place of health. Another thing that I really loved is he talked about this other secret, is that numerical growth is not inevitable. And I think that we feel the pressure as pastors to say, well, if I just do all the right things, eventually we will grow. And I feel like I will feel better about my job and who I am if we grow. But truth be told, if we are being super honest, growth is not an inevitable outcome. Sometimes there are factors so far beyond our control, right? It could be that the size of the town is in decline. It could be that there are other churches who just kind of have an established niche in the community. It could be that that people come to your church specifically because it is got a similar flavor and feel. It doesn't mean you can never grow, but it means that the type of church people are looking for, your church might fit that bill. Not everybody wants to go to a large church. It's not an excuse to do small poorly, but it isn't an acceptance to say, it's okay if this is the niche I fill in the body of Christ. But it's just not inevitable. And because it's not inevitable, I think it should hold way less weight in our mental and emotional life than it does. Because again, if growth is not inevitable, then it should not be this kind of bend over backwards type standard that we work to meet. And kind of my final chunk of thoughts here, because again, I have to be honest, I am halfway through this book, and there was so much good content that I said, man, we got to do an episode on this. We got to talk about this, because again, this book is so phenomenal. But this next chapter that I want to go over, it's about halfway through the book, and it talks about the main premise is, my church stuck or is it just small? Because again, as a small church pastor, I think we sometimes equate those two. We say, our church is just kind of stuck at this level, or I'm just really frustrated there's not more numerical growth. And truth be told, it doesn't mean our church is stuck. It just means it's small. And so we kind of have a way to determine whether or not our small is a healthy small or if it's a stuck kind of small. And so he gives us some standards, right? He says a church is stuck if it is small by mistake. And this basically means, like, if you have made mistakes in ministry, if you have ignored maintenance in your church building, if you have let leadership run rampant in areas where it shouldn't have, if you have kept toxic ministries thriving, it's kind of this idea that you're not being strategic, you're not paying attention to the mistakes that are happening in front of you, you might be stuck. You know, now, if your church is healthy, your ministries are in a good place, your leadership has been trained and developed, and you're being a good steward, then it might be that you're just small, and that's okay. There, another phrase he uses is small by exclusion, right? He says few churches exclude people on purpose, but that makes no difference to the people who feel excluded. But some people, by their restrictive theology or using making issues of things that don't matter, or just kind of creating an environment that's really clicky and unfriendly, it's like, hey, you have to take tone of the temperament of your congregation. If you see more people being ousted than being brought in, then that might be a sign that the small church culture is stuck. Again, it doesn't mean that by fixing that, you're going to suddenly balloon to hundreds of people. I mean, I hope you do. But even if you don't, you will be a healthier, more welcoming congregation. Another one is to overvalue history, right? Like, you want to honor history, but you can't be frozen in time, right? If you feel like everything has just not evolved in a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, well, eventually you go, man, we might be stuck in our current cultural trend. And then another common metric is, like, look around at your community, right? Sometimes when we look in the pews, a measure of health is to say, do my pews reflect our community? Which means if your community has all different ages, your pews should probably have all different ages. If your community is in a retirement community where everybody's older, well, then it probably is okay and downright healthier if you're actually kind of having a church that's primarily older people, because again, you're kind of meeting the need of your community. And then they talk about how a church is strategically small, meaning it's on mission, but it just happens to be small for certain reasons, right? Like one of them is that he says this. He says sometimes churches are just small for a while, But the problem with being small for a while is we don't get to decide when that time's over. Only the Lord can bring growth. And so his advice is this. Some small churches are only small for a while. The problem is no one knows how long that will last. So while you're a small church, be a great small church, right? Like, don't put all the energy into growth. Don't worry about who's coming in or how many. Just work on health. And no matter how long God puts us in a place of being a smaller congregation, it is our job to just treat that with the utmost respect and faithfulness. He uses another marker for what could be a healthy reason a church would be small. Number one, he says, if your church is small in order to reach a culture where big churches can't go, you're not stuck, you're strategic. I think some towns, some places, whether it's for economic reasons or population reasons or cultural reasons, might just reject this kind of bigger church model that brings with it more production, more programs, more buildings. And instead, this church is going to be strategic because it's meeting the need of the community. Also, they talk about how some pastors don't want to pastor a large church because it's just not, it's not their gift set. And I think that we've drawn this crazy parallel or crazy hierarchy where we say, like, well, you know, some people are kind of CEO status. They are running this large church organization where they are a pastor, yes, but they are probably more often an organizer, a team leader, a leadership developer. They're a good preacher. You know, they kind of have a different set of skills they're tapping into on a regular basis. Whereas some people say, hey, I don't really want to outsource the hospital visits. I don't really want to, necessarily turn over these ministries to other people. I want to live in that gifting of pastoring. And the thing is, thousands and thousands of church leaders throughout history have leaned into those gifts and have been so faithful and so used of the Lord to raise up people, to disciple others, to provide pastoral care, to lead the church. And I don't want us to belittle that, right? It can be strategic just to play to your strengths. And then finally, as I kind of, again, wind down this half of the book, right? The one kind of, and again, this book is not for the faint of heart. It'll hit your heart a little bit. He says a statement like this. He's talking about how sometimes we have to take a hard look at ourselves, because the thing about a small church is you don't have all the resources, right? We don't have endless money to throw at new ideas. That's why it's so hard sometimes to convince a church to do a new idea, because if we don't have the money and it tanks, man, are we going to do that again in 6 months and again in six? Eventually, we run out of money, you know? And so, so he kind of gives these pieces of advice to say, hey, here's some things as a small church you need to work on, right? He says this phrase, churches with obvious chronic dysfunctions don't attract new members because people can't stand kind of the constant drip of unaddressed problems. And longtime members don't always pitch in and help out because they've kind of gotten used to this dysfunction. And so it is super worthwhile to say, man, are there genuine leadership issues in this church? And sometimes that means you take a hard look at yourself and say, as a pastor, and whether you're a lead, associate, your area of ministry, whatever you're in charge of, are you allowing dysfunction? And as hard as it can be to right that ship, it might start with that conversation. But beyond that, we have to take a hard look and say, are the way that we are conducting, is the way we're conducting leadership productive and fruitful, or is it hindering us becoming a healthy church? He also talks about an issue that I think is very common to small town churches, is that of controlling people. And what I love about this conversation is I have heard a lot of good wisdom that says, hey, not everybody's going to find a home in the ministry. Like, you're going to have to, you know, gently show somebody the door in some cases. And I don't like disagree with that sentiment. Like, he mentions in the book, and I agree with it and heard it from others, that at some point you might encounter a deacon type or somebody in leadership who just refuses to let the pastor, who is just so enmeshed in everything that it's kind of creating this impossible scenario. And my heart goes out to, and the author's heart goes out to those situations. However, there's history with everything. And sometimes these controlling people, they either have no participation and kind of dissent that way, or they have way too many opinions. And he says, hey, these control freak types might be somebody that we just read wrong, right? Number one, he advises us, don't try to out-control them. It's probably not going to work and lead to a bitterness. Don't use your position as pastor to try and out-control them. Kind of gauge the church. Don't try and move too slow. Don't move too fast. See if you can really pray through the sweet spot. Assume honorable motives. And this is a hard one. He says, controlling church members usually have good motives. They're just going about things the wrong way, right? These people might have, for he shares a story. I'll just share, let his words kind of preach it. But he said that they were going through a facility upgrade, and every Sunday before church, one of the members came early to give the project a good once-over, you know? And then right as service was about to start, this church member would bring the list of problems and demand that the pastor know, you know, how he was going to fix them, and really just kind of call the pastor to the carpet. And Pastor Carl at some point said, hey, he decided to beat him to the punch. And so when the church member showed up, he said, hey, I'm glad you're here. There's some things you need to see. And then he went through a tour of all the problems with this church member and gave him the ways in which he was handling them. He did that 2 weeks in a row. And he said, at the end of the second week, he said, it seems like you have a handle on this. I won't need to see any more. Thanks. And he said he never brought it up again. And later, and guys, this, like, I mean, it breaks my heart, you know, because you think of how many passionate people have their own history and their own struggle and the own ways in which they've been burned. But he basically found out that there had been a previous facilities upgrade in which the pastor hadn't really been diligent, and it had cost the church thousands of dollars. And this concerned member, whether he vocalized it to the new pastor or not, which, again, we could go around saying, well, he should have, he shouldn't have. I don't think that's always up to us. But he basically said, man, this church member had a history of being burned. He had been there long enough to see pastors handle facility upgrades poorly. And so while we might get upset and frustrated that this guy is being so nosy or being, you know, quote-unquote controlling, what we're really not seeing is that there's a history of hurt that we can kind of walk through with them and earn back their trust. And I know for me, it still comes up. Even as I have shifted out of my primary role as small-town youth pastor, it still comes up in leadership constantly that oftentimes passionate, well-meaning people come off as controlling or frustrated or unhelpful. But when you dig just an inch below the surface, you find that they're carrying a lot of hurt. And it doesn't always solve immediate issues, but it can be an encouragement to us to say, hey, let's just work on trying to help these people, right? Trying to help them function. He goes on to talk about programs, and I'll wrap it up with this because, again, halfway through the book, guys. But, and this is a subject that I think has come up again and again, and it's something I'm passionate about. But the author mentioned, he said, hey, we need to have a policy. And he says, almost an unwritten rule. And he says, I know there'll be exceptions, but hear me out. And he says, don't add a new ministry until you've shut down an old one or until your capacity gets bigger. He says, he treats it like clothing. He says, if you have a small closet, if you buy a new shirt that you're going to hang up in that closet, you better throw out an old shirt that you're not wearing anymore. And you might say, well, no, there's our closet's not that cluttered. But again, I would say a cursory, you know, tour of all of our churches would find not only literal closets full of ministry things that haven't been touched in years, but often there are ineffective ministries. And not numerically small ones. Something doesn't have to be numerically big to be effective. If your Celebrate Recovery group has been changing lives, you know, of those who struggle with addiction, and you're churning out one of those changed lives every 6 months, and it's a small group of five or six people, man, that is healthy. You know, that has a lot of reasons to celebrate. But you might say, man, we used to have a killer youth ministry and those people moved away and those people graduated and now it's just not what it was. Well, then guess what? It might be that your church is entering a season where that ministry is just not what you're known for, and that has to be okay. And so he makes the case. He says, hey, it takes bravery. It takes even ruthlessness is probably too strong a word, but it takes a genuine spirit of prayer, of saying we want not just the choice we've always made, but the best ministry choice. And it takes a pastoral care to navigate leaders through the sunrise and sunset of certain ministries. And so, again, we're already at almost 35 minutes here. But guys, I'm telling you, read this book. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. And then tune in a couple weeks as we interview Carl Vaders on his other two books. Again, I'll have the link to all three in the show notes. But again, I have just been so blessed by just the straightforward nature of this, the sincere wisdom coming from these pages. And so as always, you know, here at Rural Advancement, we hope that this podcast has encouraged and empowered you. We hope that you feel like it's not just speaking to you, but really speaks from a place that understands the unique, but also sometimes common struggles that we go through. I've been your host, Joe Epley. As usual, in the informal channels, I encourage you to spread this podcast by word of mouth, but also I want to encourage you especially. We have just seen this podcast touch a lot of people, but I know that there's some really firm metrics in which this podcast can kind of grow, and sometimes leaving a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify is so helpful to the growth of what we do and having more people be impacted by the messages we're hearing. But for this week, I've been Joe Epley, and I've been your host. There's no guests, so I don't even get to say that part, but we'll see you next week.